Chapter 10. Relief to a man to make a confession. I wish to unburden my mind now, and yet I almost believe that I am moved to do it more, because I long to bring censure upon another man, than because I desire to pour balm upon my wounded heart. I don't know what balm is, but I believe it is the correct expression to use in this connection, never having seen any balm. You may remember that I lectured in Newark lately for the young gentlemen of the Dash Society? I did at any rate. During the afternoon of that day I was talking with one of the young gentlemen just referred to, and he said he had an uncle who, from some cause or other, seemed to have grown permanently bereft of all emotion. And with tears in his eyes, this young man said, "Oh, if I could only see him laugh once more! Oh, if I could only see him weep!" I was touched. I could never withstand distress. I said, "Colin, bring him to my lecture. I'll start him for you. Oh, if you could but do it. If you could but do it, all our family would bless you forevermore, for he is so very dear to us. Oh, my benefactor, can you make him laugh? Can you bring soothing tears to those parched orbs?" I was profoundly moved. I said, "Colin, my son, bring the old party round. I have got some jokes in that lecture that will make him laugh, if there is any laugh in him. And if they misfire, I have got some others that will make him cry or kill him, one or the other." Then the young man blessed me, and wept on my neck, and went after his uncle. He placed him in full view, in the second row of benches, that night, and I began on him. I tried him with mild jokes, then with severe ones. I dosed him with bad jokes, and riddled him with good ones. I fired old stale jokes into him, and peppered him fore and aft with red-hot new ones. I warmed up to my work, and assaulted him on the right and left, in front and behind. I fumed and sweated and charged and ranted till I was hoarse and sick and frantic and furious. But I never moved him once. I never started a smile or a tear. Never a ghost of a smile, and never a suspicion of moisture. I was astounded. I closed the lecture at last with one despairing shriek, with one wild burst of humor, and hurled a joke of supernatural atrocity full at him. Then I sat down bewildered and exhausted. The president of the society came up and bathed my head with cold water, and said, "Colin, what made you carry on so toward the last?" I said, "Colin, I was trying to make that confounded old fool laugh, in the second row." And he said, "Colin, well, you were wasting your time, because he is deaf and dumb, and as blind as a badger." Now, was that any way for that old man's nephew to impose on a stranger and orphan like me? I ask you as a man and brother, if that was any way for him to do? The office boy, written about 1869, he arrives just as regularly as the clock strikes 9 in the morning. And so he even beats the editor sometimes, and the porter must leave his work, and climb 2 or 3 pairs of stairs, to unlock the sanctum door, and let him in. He lights one of the office pipes, not reflecting, perhaps, that the editor may be one of those tuck-up people who would as soon have a stranger defile his toothbrush as his pipe stem. Then he begins to loll for a person who can consent to loaf his useless life away in ignominious indolence has not the energy to sit up straight. He stretches full length on the sofa a while, then draws up to half length, then gets into a chair, hangs his head back and his arms abroad, and stretches his legs till the rims of his boot heels rest upon the floor. By and by sits up and leans forward, with one leg or both over the arm of the chair. But it is still observable that with all his changes of position, he never assumes the upright or a fraudful affectation of dignity. From time to time he yawns, and stretches, and scratches himself with a tranquil, mangy enjoyment, and now and then he grunts a kind of stuffy, overfed grunt, which is full of animal contentment. At rare and long intervals, however, he sighs a sigh that is the eloquent expression of a secret confession, to wit, a useless and a nuisance, a cumberer of the earth. The boar and his comrades, for there are usually from 2 to 4 on hand, day and night mix into the conversation. When men come in to see the editors for a moment on business, they hold noisy talks among themselves about politics in particular, and all other subjects in general, even warming up, after a fashion, sometimes, and seeming to take almost a real interest in what they are discussing. They ruthlessly call an editor from his work with such a remark as, colon, did you see this, Smith, in the Gazette? And proceed to read the paragraph, while the sufferer reins in his impatient pen and listens. They often loll and sprawl around the office hour after hour, swapping anecdotes and relating personal experiences to each other, hairbreadth escapes, social encounters with distinguished men, election reminiscences, sketches of odd characters, etc. And through all those hours they never seem to comprehend that they are robbing the editors of their time and the public of journalistic excellence in next day's paper. At other times they drowse, or dreamily pore over exchanges, or droop limp and pensive over the chair arms for an hour. Even this solemn silence is small respite to the editor, for the next uncomfortable thing to having people look over his shoulders, perhaps, is to have them sit by in silence and listen to the scratching of his pen. If a body desires to talk private business with one of the editors, he must call him outside, for no hint milder than blasting powder or nitroglycerin would be likely to move the bores out of listening distance. To have to sit and endure the presence of a bore day after day, to feel your cheerful spirits begin to sink as his footstep sounds on the stair, and utterly vanish away as his tiresome form enters the door, to suffer through his anecdotes, and die slowly to his reminiscences, to feel always the fetters of his clogging presence, to long hopelessly for one single day's privacy, to note with a shudder, by and by, that to contemplate his funeral in fancy has ceased to soothe, to imagine him undergoing in strict and fearful detail the tortures of the ancient Inquisition has lost its power to satisfy the heart, and that even to wish him millions and millions and millions of miles in Tophead is able to bring only a fitful gleam of joy. To have to endure all this, day after day, and week after week, and month after month, is an affliction that transcends any other that men suffer. Physical pain is pastime to it, and hanging a pleasure excursion. Johnny Greer, the church was densely crowded, that lovely summer Sabbath, said the Sunday school superintendent, and all, as their eyes rested upon the small coffin, seemed impressed by the poor black boy's fate. Above the stillness the pastor's voice rose, and chained the interest of every ear as he told, with many an envied compliment, how that the brave, noble, daring little Johnny Greer, when he saw the drowned body sweeping down toward the deep part of the river, whence the agonized parents never could have recovered it in this world, gallantly sprang into the stream, and, at the risk of his life, towed the corpse to shore, and held it fast till help came and secured it. Johnny Greer was sitting just in front of me. A ragged street boy, with eager eye, turned upon him instantly, and said in a hoarse whisper, "No, but did you, though? ?" Towed the carcass ashore, and saved it yourself? ? Cracky. What did they give you? ? Nothing. ? With intense disgust, do you know what I'd a done? I'd a anchored him out in the stream, and said, $5, gents, or you can't have yo nigger. The facts in the case of the great beef, contract written about 1867. In as few words as possible I wish to lay before the nation what's here, howsoever small, I have had in this matter which has so exercised the public mind, engendered so much ill feeling, and so filled the newspapers of both continents with distorted statements and extravagant comments. The origin of this distressful thing was this, and I assert here that every fact in the following resume can be amply proved by the official records of the general government. John Wilson Mackenzie, of Rotterdam, Cumming County, New Jersey, deceased, contracted with the general government, on or about the 10th day of October, 1861, to furnish to General Sherman the sum total of 30 barrels of beef. Very well. He started after Sherman with the beef, but when he got to Washington, Sherman had gone to Manassas. So he took the beef, and followed him there, but arrived too late. He followed him to Nashville, and from Nashville to Chattanooga, and from Chattanooga to Atlanta, but he never could overtake him. At Atlanta he took a fresh start, and followed him clear through his march to the sea. He arrived too late again by a few days, but hearing that Sherman was going out in the Quaker City excursion to the Holy Land, he took shipping for Beirut, calculating to head off the other vessel. When he arrived in Jerusalem with his beef, he learned that Sherman had not sailed in the Quaker City, but had gone to the plains to fight the Indians. He returned to America and started for the Rocky Mountains. After 68 days of arduous travel on the plains, and when he had got within 4 miles of Sherman's headquarters, he was tomahawked and scalped, and the Indians got the beef. They got all of it but one barrel. Sherman's army captured that, and so, even in death, the bold navigator partly fulfilled his contract. In his will, which he had kept like a journal, he bequeathed the contract to his son Bartholomew W. Bartholomew W. made out the following bill, and then died. The United States, an account with John Wilson Mackenzie, of New Jersey, deceased, doctor, to 30 barrels of beef for General Sherman, at $100, $3, 000 to traveling expenses and transportation. $14,000 total. $17,000 record paid. He died then, but he left the contract to W.M. J. Martin, who tried to collect it, but died before he got through. He left it to Barker J. Allen, and he tried to collect it also. He did not survive. Barker J. Allen left it to Anson G. Rogers, who attempted to collect it, and got along as far as the Ninth Auditor's office, when Death, the Great Leveler, came all unsummoned, and foreclosed on him also. He left the bill to a relative of his in Connecticut, Vengeance Hopkins by name, who lasted 4 weeks and 2 days, and made the best time on record, coming within one of reaching the 12th Auditor. In his will he gave the contract bill to his uncle, by the name of O.B. Joyful Johnson. It was too undermining for Joyful. His last words were, "Colon, weep not for me, I am willing to go." And so he was, poor soul. 7 people inherited the contract after that, but they all died. So it came into my hands at last. It fell to me through a relative by the name of Hubbard, Bethlehem Hubbard, of Indiana. He had had a grudge against me for a long time, but in his last moments he sent for me, and forgave me everything, and, weeping, gave me the beef contract. This ends the history of it up to the time that I succeeded to the property. I will now endeavor to set myself straight before the nation in everything that concerns my share in the matter. I took this beef contract, and the bill for mileage and transportation, to the President of the United States. He said, "Well, sir, what can I do for you?" I said, "Sire, on or about the Elzareth day of October, 1861, John Wilson Mackenzie, of Rotterdam, Cumming County, New Jersey, deceased, contracted with the general government, to furnish to General Sherman the sum total of 30 barrels of beef." He stopped me there, and dismissed me from H.I. presence, kindly, but firmly. The next day called on the Secretary of State. He said, "Well, sir?" I said, "Your Royal Highness, on or about the 10th day of October, 1861, John Wilson Mackenzie of Rotterdam, Cumming County, New Jersey, deceased, contracted with the general government, to furnish to General Sherman the sum total of 30 barrels of beef." "That will do, sir, that will do. This office has nothing to do with contracts for beef." I was bowed out. I thought the matter all over, and finally, the following day, I visited the Secretary of the Navy, who said, "Speak quickly, sir. Do not keep me waiting." I said, "Your Royal Highness, on or about the 10th day of October, 1861, John Wilson Mackenzie of Rotterdam, Kemen County, New Jersey, deceased, contracted with the general government to General Sherman the sum total of 30 barrels of beef." Well, it was as far as I could get. He had nothing to do with beef contracts for General Sherman either. I began to think it was a curious kind of government. It looked somewhat as if they wanted to get out of paying for that beef. The following day I went to the Secretary of the Interior. I said, "Your Imperial Highness, on or about the 10th day of October, that is sufficient, sir. I have heard of you before. Go, take your infamous beef contract out of this establishment. The Interior Department has nothing, whatever, to do with subsistence for the army." I went away. But I was exasperated now. I said I would haunt them. I would infest every department of this iniquitous government till that contract business was settled. I would collect that bill, or fall, as fell my predecessors, trying. I assailed the Postmaster General. I beseeched the Agricultural Department. I waylaid the Speaker of the House of Representatives. They had nothing to do with army contracts for beef. I moved upon the Commissioner of the Patent Office. I said, "Your August Excellency, on or about perdition. Have you got here with your incendiary beef contract, at last? We have nothing to do with beef contracts for the army, my dear sir." "Oh, that is all very well, but somebody has got to pay for that beef. It has got to be paid now too, or I'll confiscate this old patent office, and everything in it." "But, my dear sir, it don't make any difference, sir. The patent office is liable for that beef, I reckon. And, liable or not liable, the patent office has got to pay for it. Never mind the details. It ended in a fight. The patent office won. But I found out something to my advantage. I was told that the Treasury Department was the proper place for me to go to. I went there. I waited 2 hours and a half, and then I was admitted to the First Lord of the Treasury." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.